going to focus on the cotton industry. Why I've had the weeds earlier in particular. So early cotton manufacturing in Bristol was as follows. Hang on a minute, sit down. Anybody know where the cotton industry in Bristol?
Yeah.
From 1695, which is just before Bristol was legally allowed to trade the slaves, 1698, the merchant venturers were lobbying to have cotton spinning by children introduced into workhouses. The workhouses did that, they did work. You weren't allowed to go to a workhouse and just sit down and do work. And the merchant venturers wanted to import cotton from the West Indies onto the Americas to get work by children. About the same time the city got its status as city council, I believe. The cotton industry was spurred on by the decline in the woolen industry and also by the slave trade, the developing slave trade. They needed those garments to go trade in Africa. Especially the bright coloured garments. Lots of those came out from Africa. Bright coloured cotton garments to trade for slaves. The merchant venturers actually petitioned Parliament to lift restrictions on cotton imports, which I referred to earlier. As I mentioned, their importance of cotton for the purchase of Negroes. Slaves grew the cotton and traded the slaves. They are a complete monopoly on trade. Three-way monopoly in that triangle. Protected by the British Navy and the Army. 1774, there was bleaching fields between Lawford's Gate, where all those beavers were popping off every few minutes. Yeah. Which is between Lawford's Gate and Stapleton Road on the River Froome, the mighty beautiful River Froome. There's a cotton mill opposite Hopwells, on the other side of the bank from Hopwells. In other words, Caensham Bitton, cotton works. And there was one discovered at Leinster as well, built in about 1754, one of the first cotton factories in the southwestern area, the River Severn area. So there's big trade going to Manchester. Cotton would come to Bristol and go up to Manchester as well as the local cotton works, grew up by pack holes. Leinster was halfway. Come in from Liverpool, come in from Bristol, go up to the little village of Leinster and be sent in goods. 1794, there was a cotton manufacturer in Temple Street in Redcliffe in the area, using steam engines as looms and all the usual equipment. 1816, in Ann Street outside Wharford's Gate, there was another factory mentioned by the River Froome. In 1836, just after they got the compensation of his people, they were preparing quite considerably. And they'd been preparing since 1895 for the cotton industry, and it had been happening. But now there were big developments, and they had this surplus capital. What can they do? Put it in the bank. Oh dear me, we are the banks. What are we going to do with it now? Well, we'll have to invest it somewhere. How about the Caribbean? How about not? Yeah. Didn't go back to where it had come from as well. Stayed in England. Prospectus for a new cotton company called the Bristol Cotton Company with a proposed capital of £2.5 million. Selling points were cheap and abundant female and child labour in the area. Coal from South Gloucestershire and set Caulfield and the waterways. And would you believe it, the same people were involved in the feeder canal and all the water developments, the feeder canal.
canal and right bang out Rock Hill.
The same people climbing over. And then in May 21st, 1836, two more prospectuses for the Bristol and Bitten cotton twist manufactory. The second one was for the Bristol Cotton Twist and Power Loom Cloth Company, a snappy little title there, with a provisional committee of wealthy Bristolians who actually went on to float this company a year later, with a man called J.B. Clark from Manchester, who had the expertise of big production cotton manufacturing. Let's work. Mr. Akram, Mr. Akram with the hammer. He was there, a big player, a big engineering company in Bristol. So they'd been making machinery, supplying machinery for the works. One of the only machines that was did to make machinery in St. Philip's, where the city place is now. Prospector states, the land would be obtained for a reasonable figure. They'd already sewn it up, actually, with a local potter who moved in and bought the land on their behalf on the sly. I've got into that one here. We bought it at a really cheap price before anybody realised the merchants were interested in buying the land. And where wealthy inhabitants would be exposed to no inconvenience or well away from Clifton. But, yeah, it's going to be. Everybody else got the inconvenience in the night. The land was actually the last enclosure within the borough. All process of enclosing land. The last piece of vacant land that was enclosed. So it's the last free bit. It's a little canal right next to it. You feel like building more of it and then buying the land next to it. Exactly the same thing happened. So they built the cotton fireproof mill, and it held 1,000 power looms. 1,000 looms. The barge brought the mill up from the floating harbour, as it says, built in 1809 by the exactly the same families who ran the city. And the Great Western Cotton Works replaced all those other mills that I was talking about that Sir Walter's game. In and around us, along the River Chew and the Eddy. And the name Great Western was a deliberate choice of name and coordinated with the Great Western Steamship Company and the Great Western Railway. And the reason they called it the Great Western was because of what happened in 1831. Yay, 1831! Nobody wanted to invest in Bristol. If you called anything Bristol, it was, no, burn it down. Yeah. So get the hands out and break it up. So everything became called the Great Western. And it was actually a great Western design, because that also included South Wales. Yeah, the other side of the River Severn, where the copper and brass works, owned by Bristol, the bankers and industrialists, was flourishing. So they saw the Great Western Railway as getting those products from South Wales across the Severn onto the railway and not shooting down to London. All the coal, all the copper, all the grass, and so forth, the megacity of London. And that's where the Great Western thing came from. Not because of any great or because they didn't want to be calling it. And it was big! Yeah, 1,000 power looms, it was big plumbing thing in there, yeah? Every month, it was a field, and overnight they built this massive complex of that, employing thousands of women and children. The owners were Mr. Pinney, Charles Pinney, Rob Bryce, Peter Aitken, John Daniel Akrams, Hammerman, and Peter Mays. And 1845-50, the company became known as Mays, Ames and Bush Company. We'll look at Robert Bright first. Bright's a wealthy merchant family. Yeah, they've done all over stuff in the Caribbean, the state of others, you name it. They were responsible for at least 21 slaving voyages out of Bristol in 23 years. That's one a year. 450 slaves in each ship. Do the maths. How many people they kidnapped and sold on?
They look at 29 Queen Square, which is that beautiful building, which is now the English Heritage Centre. And the detail on the pillar to this cornucopia, which is the symbol of plenty. They were also the founding partners of the Bristol Bank, which included Richard Bright, Levi Ames, John Cave, the Harfords, the Daubneys, all the big slaving families, and Ames was also involved in the copper works as well. They were a well integrated, tightly knit community of people around the city. John Daniel, Daniel family had 3,000, nearly 4,000 slaves in six islands. As I said before, they received £117,000 compensation. They were the biggest sugar merchants in Bristol. Thomas Daniel was called King of Bristol. And I believe, I can't check it out, I'm sure they lived in Barnet Square, top of Park Street. So they just round the corner from Finney, who was also a sugar merchant. As well. And Bristol's North Cloister, there are monuments. There it is. Monument, plaque that the cherub is leaning on. It says, sacred to the memory of Thomas Daniel, respected merchant of the city, born in Barbados, 14th March 1730, departed the life of his life. 23rd day. And it was his son who inherited the compensation. In the Great Western, not just the Great Western Cotton Work. And they're all there. Yeah, you've got our old churches, they're all plaques, they're all. Mr. Pinney, Charles Pinney. Zariah Pinney fled England, as I said, going part of the Monmouth Rebellion. He was a rebel. He bought land in Nevis. And using slaves created a plantation. His son was John Pinney the First. He married a neighbouring plantation owner's daughter and joined his estates together. And then his grandson was actually John Pinney the Second. Between 65 when he went out to Nevis, born in Bristol, went out to Nevis for 5 years. 40 slaves in those 5 years, out of 250 died through exhaustion, sickness, and suicide. Father and child, many slaves, I was trying to escape. Continual nightmare, as you can see. Convinced himself that owning slaves was acceptable in 1765, he wrote, "Since my arrival, I purchased 9 slaves in St. Kitts and can assure you I was shocked at the first appearance of human flesh for sale. But surely God ordained them for use and benefit of us. Otherwise, his divine will would have made manifest to us some other particular sign or token." Long time to say, couldn't figure it out at all. In 83, sometime later, when he got the real hand, okay. "The people who seemed devoted to our destruction, they entertain the most horrid degrees of our cruelties. It now pervades all ranks of people. They think slavery ought not to be permitted in any part of the British dominion." In continual fear, uprising, poison, stabbing, burning down. When he died, he left £750,000 worth of 1,700 a day. And John Pitt. There he is. Yeah, you can see. Yeah, they had it all over the world. Yeah, they all got together in St. George, in Great George Street a couple of years ago at a family reunion.
It's good.
It's kind of, you know, all those people ask him, still in a sense. It's good that people talk about it. It's good. And it was John Pinney who had the, I was going to say, Perro's Bridge. And there's the, there's the sheet, the little white bit going across shows and buying. Perro and also Perro's sister as well. Charles Binney. Displays of Mark Burney, of branding, to show that he was their owner. They used wooden blocks, net blocks, or clogs. As punishment, so he couldn't lie down. Slaves ran away frequently, he said, and were sent off the island. If they kept them running away, sold them on. There was a jail, it was only a small island. Jail, possibly at the plantation itself, and an overseer with a reputation for cruelty. In 1800, he ordered his manager not to allow a Negro to be corrected in the presence of Tom Wedgwood, who was the son of Josiah Wedgwood, the Quaker, who campaigned against slavery, or so near for him to hear the whip. Point out the comforts the Negroes enjoy beyond the poor in this country, beyond the poor in England. It's an idea of how poor people were in this country as well. Show him the property they possess. This means he will leave the island possessed of his faithful sentiments. Charles took over the penny business, inherited his share of the fortune, 17 million quid, increased the fortune. And before he died, his dad gave him the house to have a museum. He went on to become the mayor of Bristol during the Reform Uprising, Rebellion. Yeah, he's responsible for all that. And there's the house. And he didn't stay there long, because he got to come in with a load of money in about 1833, 34. It was a big wad of money. And he moved to a new house, which is now the engineer's house. That's next to where the Lord Mayor's house is now. Camp House, it's called. So, I've got that money for the islands. So, George Finney and William Wimblethorpe, they didn't actually get married. But Charles Finney wanted to marry William Wimblethorpe's daughter. Yeah. Was that close? This is William Wimblethorpe, the great liberator. He's a great, liberal, wonderful man. His daughter was going to marry the guy who branded his clogs, vanished. You know, Wilberforce pops over the island, make sure he doesn't hear the wind. Yeah? And I think Wilberforce only backed out of it because, you know, the social embarrassment for him. He had to get permission for his daughter with his property, with the men's property. We pick up the property of Charles Pinney. It's connected to the whole Bristol. Anyway, it didn't happen. So it's kind of relation these people have there. Peter Mays, another director of the Cotton Works, very close friend of Brunel, and also a merchant adventurer. It's nice to have a connection with Brunel. There's a Cotton Works, massive. Similar kind of sketch from Loxton about 1900.
1905, probably.
Showing the women going in. Huge. And that's it, showing its proximity to the feeder canal. Because all the cotton came up with that canal. It's unloaded in there, processed, woven into fabric, and then sent back to the canal, sent to the port, or the railway. Through the back. Gives an idea of this Simon. Five stories high, it's full of girls and women. St. Luke's Church, that was built by William Kinney. He also had a church built on Nevis as well, a Moravian church. That's what they did. Control system. Conditions in Barton Hill were absolutely atrocious. Cotton was working Barton Hill from 1837 to 1926, nearly 1 year. And up to 1865, that was slave grown cotton. And that was 1865, it wasn't far off slave grown cotton. Now, I won't play a time run out of time. A bit of music. Somebody made a thing called King Cotton, a local musician. CD of King Cotton, really good.
Franklin plantations and your histories of the women who worked in the cotton works here.
This is where the cotton came from in the end, from the Mississippi Delta. It's a major cotton growing area in America. Total number of slaves, 1830, before the freedom of slaves in the British colonies, which America wasn't become. It's not too clear. It's this is Mississippi, 70,000 slaves in 1830. Okay. Virginia with its tobacco plantations, nearly half a million slaves in 1830. Okay. South Carolina next door, North Carolina next door to Virginia. Yeah. Georgia, nearly 250,000. But Mississippi, all that area where they grew cotton, very few slaves in 1830. But that was rapidly about to change. South Carolina is the largest exporter of cotton until overtaken by Alabama from Mississippi. The invention of the spinning wheel jenny in England, which we talked about, and the cotton gin, which is a way of separating the cotton by machine from the pod, the cotton pod, enable cotton to replace wool as a staple for clothes, and cotton clothes became cheaper through mechanisation. The major source is cotton of the Deep South. Cotton was harvested using what's called stoop labour, back-breaking work. Virginia wasn't the cotton, major cotton producer, half a million slaves. But started to export its slaves to other states. And in fact, the revival of the cotton industry in the Americas revived slavery. It was teetering on the brink. But the cotton industry in Britain and in Europe reinvigorated the whole slave system in the South. The generation of the American Revolution was succeeded by a Southern generation which was in favor of slavery. American Revolution is going to do away with slavery. Pain and all. American Revolution was 17.
Come on, come on.
Was it? 76. There you go. I get it. The debate of the French Revolution. No problem. The American Revolution followed closely on the French Revolution. It inspired that. The Mississippi Delta was cleared of woodland. And this is where the cotton. Just like the clearing woodland in South America now, they cleared it right across the Mississippi. And with it came a demand for labour. And Mississippi entered the American Union in 1817. There were 70,000 people living there, including 30,000 who were black, that's 43%. By 1860, 4 years later, the population was 750,000, an 11% increase, of whom nearly 500,000 were black slaves. They came from Sogon. The Civil War, slaves worked on plantations that stretched from Virginia, east of the Mississippi, and in Texas as well, east of Washington, all the time in the camp. On bigger plantations, they were supervised by drivers, tasks were allocated to the slaves, and if you didn't fulfill your task, people would fear and tremble at not completing their task. They were whipped, flogged, starved. Unless you can read, people to death. We're not working out, are we? After the Civil War, the South had to abandon slavery, but came up with the idea of tenant farming, just sharecropping. So you still worked it, and then you sold it to the landowner. You were a tenant on the land. Everything had to go to the landowner, had to come and store. Tools through them, food through them. We still have an old name. So it's like just some plantation owners have their own currency called script, and in Texas, labor often came from prison gangs. So in the film, and they were predominantly black. And that was the source of labor. Still is.
There's a cotton gin.
Invented in 1783, 8 years after the first bale of cotton arrived in the US.
And there's one in 1915. I quite like
it. Interesting, all the white guys on the floor, all the shirt, so you've got a tie on. All the labour, so we've got the top chair.
Safe then?
Yeah.
All the dungarees.
It's a definite kind of hierarchy. Interesting shot. That's intense.
So they were the units got bigger.
This is the cotton works nowadays in C. Aitken Street. It's one of the owners of the cotton works. And the local street names, May Street, Bush Street, Aitken Street, and Pinney Terrace. Because they owned it, they built it. They named streets after themselves. That's one of the remaining power loom cotton weaving sheds named May's House. Mr. May, Peter May's. The sheds contained eventually 1,600 looms. That's the entrance gate, and that is the last cotton work going into the town. That's not. That's the entrance gate, it's still there. Okay. Short history of Barton and Works. A number of the workers came down from Lancashire, probably brought by the owner, I suspect. They probably walked from Lancashire down here. 37, the SS Great Western steamship was launched, and on its first cargo was American slave grown cotton. The sound as what was possible. And that's why that ship was built.
Great Western.
Great Western, yeah. That came afterwards. Same company, Reuben Ellenco. And what they wanted to do was beat all arrivals, get it across America, and bring the stuff back, process it in Britain. The mill employed 923 people, including 609 girls, 113 boys.
So 700 people were kids, and 900
in the mill. All the bales of cotton arriving on the Oconee, this is a cotton growing area in Georgia. The cotton was also brought from Liverpool. St. Luke's Church foundation stone was laid a few years later. It's a big fanfare, merchant venturers, Freemasons, families, all the owners, organizations. It was exported all over the world, including China. 1845, the children missed a day's work. They were put in prison. Mr. Pinney applying plantation law to the people of Bristol. In prison in Mr. Day's work. The people organised to get this changed, and they did. They went on strike, lobbying for
that.
He died of consumption.
No,
yeah. Mr. Day's work. Just like
12 years previously, they were flogging people for not working hard enough in the sugar plantations.
It's the same people, same culture. 49 measured 2,000 workers in the cotton shed of capacity of 10 to 12,000 bales of cotton coming from the United States. 49, Barton Hill was hit by the cholera epidemic. 31 people died. Poverty report said the houses, just 12 years old, were in a very poor condition and no back windows. 61 to 65, southern ports were blockaded during the American Civil War. Factory clouds are closed. And in 63, there was 117 burials in St. Luke's Church, 70 of which children under 5, compared with the whole total of 78 people who were buried in the same church in 1860. That's the Catholic church. So the people starving on the edge of the city. 83 out of 1,000 people, 70% were women. 1883. When good old Queen Victoria, probably having a statue unveiled in the little town. the only female one. 1890, there was a massive strike. It lasted a month. And they got the support of the dockers who refused to handle cotton. Front Park Hill and Liverpool dockers also. Ben Tilly, Bonnie Eastern, Scott Felix, Brody Eastern, who organised the Transport General Workers Union, very, very in favour of it all. Eventually, they had to give in to demands, and they were organised by two women, Miriam Daniels and Helena Bourne. They were both Christian non-conformist, quite wealthy family. I think they're school teachers, actually. And they left their homes in Redland, I think it was, and moved just across the Peter Canal to support the workers. They were brilliant, fantastic organisers in the 1880s. So that was the Cottonwood. The gas company, Bristol Gas Company, established in 1816, leading shareholder was Mr. Kinney. This was the headquarters until 1936. And he, funnily enough, had a gas concession to supply the gas works, and he got the gas for the Cottonwoods. And this is the inside of that building in 72. Are you recognising it, where it is? Yeah. Cannons Mark Gas Works. Yeah. You can see one of the old gas holders there. And then today, you can see lots of cranes on the docks, huh? 72. Or defined, 74, I think, that's a ship, yeah. There's the gas company, which is now the tourist information place. And that's it pretty much today. I've developed a bit more now. It's going to be well heeled houses, aren't they? In the river. The suspension bridge. When the people had a rising in 1831, they had to stop working the suspension bridge for 5 years. The bridge was finally finished in 1864, and all the same people we've been talking about were involved in financing that. Great Western Railway, the GWR, and the Great Western Steamship Company, maybe SS Great Britain and the SS Great Western, and the SS Great Eastern. Yeah. First board members, Robert Bright, John Cave, George Gibbs, Mr. Gubby, John Harford, William Sigurd Jack, George Jones, and Peter Mays. Peter Mays, Sheriff Norman, Nicholas Roche. And the bankers were Miles Harford & Co. Elton Bailey, Ames and Co. Yeah, here's a couple of them. Then Robert Bryce was the deputy chair, 259 shares, which he bought for £1.5 million. Bryce, slave family, compensation money, merchant, also in the Great Western Cotton Works. John Cave, member of the Bristol Corporation, banker with money from slavery, big time. And backers. George Gibbs had 50 shares, £300,000. Merchant venturer, senior partner of Gibbs, Bright & Co., Bristol and Liverpool, who finally became the owners of the SS Great Britain, Gibbs Bright. And they traded with Australia, used that to trade in Australia, cargo vessel. So Gubby was a sugar refiner, and a prominent merchant, 253 shares, worth £1.5 million. Contributed to the design of the SS Great Britain and the Great Western, and he got all those partners together. He was the driving force for getting together to create a ship which wasn't under sail, but was an iron ship under steam and sail, which could dramatically reduce the amount of time it took to get from America the west coast in Liverpool to get those things back. Very, 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 very close. Brunel, and of course, that time, all the cotton is slave from. Guppy, sugar refiner, prominent merchant, and shares worth £1.5 million. He was involved in the SS Great Britain and the Great Western, the whole company. Really
yourself here. She's a very close friend of Brunel. Another friend of Brunel, this guy, Christopher Claxton, major shareholder in the Great Western Steamship Company, who built the SS Great Britain since the Cuban Crisis. Ex-slaving agent in Antigua. Bristol family with plantations in St. Kitts. He campaigned for the continuity of slavery in 1831, with a racist petition in 1830, the election we talked about, Colorado and Bailey, saying black people were unfit for emancipation because they were a barbarous race. Close friend of Brunel, I think this is Soviet, my student.
John Harford, one of the directors of the banks, also in the other railway companies. Signe Jacques, Chamber of Commerce, Jones, involved in other railways. Peter Mays, involved in Copper Works, close friend of Brunel, merchant venturer. Rush, an influential businessman, very wealthy, and involved in the Bristol Dock Company, which was all part of this whole development over 30, 40 years. The bankers of Miles, Harford and Co., involved part of the brass industry, copper industry, which was all founded in 1697, 2 years before the Bristol allowed trading slaves. In Eastern, that's the industry in Britain was founded. Elton Bailey, Ames and Co. There's the sheds. They're very palatial places for first class customers to eat and drink. Put the picture on here, which I have now. It was commemorated in 1985, 150 years since it was started. No mention of where the money came from. Coal, always seems to be driven by coal. This is an ad for Eastern Colliery, which is where Felix Road Adventure Playground is now. That's Eastern Colliery. You can see the centre all over the city. Hemmings Waste, is a deliverer. That's where they started on the transport. Coal. A direct result of the trade. Blah 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 blah. 1830, the Leonard family, third paragraph down, were large landowners. They bought all the mineral rights in Eastern. So they could exploit it for all this new growth of industrial use of coal. In the 1870s, massive production out of the decline. Coal just followed what was happening elsewhere. Very few plaques commemorating this history of Bristol. This is one by the Industrial Museum, unveiled by Ian White during the European Year Against Racism. Have you seen it? It's quite small. They're all quite small. There's the one for Thomas Clarkson, which local council has been campaigning for these plants to go. It's kind of break them over a bit. It's the great of good. Again, it's quite small, and that's above the Seven Stars pub door. And that's Perros Bridge, but you have to work really hard to find the plant that says it's Perros Bridge. It's on this side, it's a stone, and it's right down here. But everybody just walks by the bridge. But in other countries, they commemorate it differently. It's Haiti, the Black Maroon, in Barbados. Not hidden on the floor. Anyway, UC Road, but no. Yeah. It's a beautiful mural. With hope. All designed by local people. The works itself. Cotton works. You made it. Oh, well done. There you go. It's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. beautiful, beautiful. They're not this big, aren't they?
Yeah.
Designs all the way down. And sort of bejeweled, I love that one. One World. Typical statement by local people. So what form should any public testament take on this? Does Barton Bill show the way?
I think maybe they can. Thank you.
Any questions?
Rogers at the back.